weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to you, Johnnies. It's Tuesday, the 12th of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, Miguel Delaney on Lee Carsley chatter, Mark Langdon on the international window so far. Plus, we're live to Turner's Cross as our under-21s aim for 2 wins from 2 in our Euros qualifying campaign.
And in tennis, we'll look at the rise of US Open champ Coco Gauff, and we'll also meet Ireland sports' latest success story, Junior World Rally champion William Creighton. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome along, Ruby. Before we get into everything that is happening today, I have been hearing throughout the afternoon about the Laytown races, and it's not something I'm hugely familiar with, but just seeing some pictures, it looks like it's a bit of crack.
Oh, it is a great day out, Marie. And used to traditionally run on the August Bank Holiday weekend, but it had to be moved. It's now running early September, racing on the beach. Obviously, they can't build the race course till the tide goes out, so they have to build the whole track on the day, which they do. They have a wonderful committee, 6 races. They're all running a straight line, varying from 6 to 7 furlongs. And if you happen to have been in the Laytown, Bettystown, anywhere between Drogheda and North Dublin, I'm sure it would be a great day out. And there's a huge crowd there. I think there's, if you could calculate them, they said there was 10,000 in Leperstown at the weekend. I've a funny feeling it looks to be more people in Laytown.
Oh, right. Okay, I'm going to ask a stupid question. We're live on air, but I'm going to go for it. Would you have ever ridden up there?
I did. No. I rode a winner there many moons ago. The weights, many years ago, Marie, there was an incident there that involved the horses galloped into a lake that was a bit, a flow of water that was too big, and a few horses fell, a couple of jockeys were injured, a couple of horses were injured, and a lot of changes had to be made to racing on the beach. And they brought about a lot of improvements. At that time, they used to have races where they'd race down by the sea, turn and come back up by the shore. So that was, they did away with that, and they race now in a straight line. It's, and that's why it was moved off the August Bank Holiday weekend as well. Less people on the beach, obviously. And okay, it was moved a lot, just safety, health and safety, the welfare of horses and for riders as well. But when they did that at Laytown, they raised the weights, which encouraged for flat racing more jump jockeys to ride, so that you had heavier people available to ride on the beach, because there's also flat racing this afternoon in Galway. So rather than having youngsters riding them, they wanted more experienced people, and hence I ended up riding a winner at Laytown.
So you're a heavy jockey. Well, you were a heavy jockey.
I was a fat jockey, Marie, yeah.
You said it, not me. Okay, I didn't know that, so I wouldn't have categorised you as that without knowing a huge amount about it.
Yeah, I weighed 10 stone all my life, but to be a flat jockey, you would want to be under 9 stone.
Okay. Am I right in saying Rachel Blackmore is riding in Laytown?
She is in Laytown. Paul Townham was there earlier, Michael O'Sullivan.
All right.
Plenty of big names there, yeah.
Very good. By the time we get off air, will it be over?
I think the last is 7:15, I think.
Might get the last race at Laytown on the telly somewhere or on the internet.
Well, you might at the moment. Yeah. New gambling regulations come in. Oh, right. I'm afraid you mightn't get any Irish. You mightn't get any Irish racing anywhere.
Loads of things now today. Okay, none of this I knew. Right. Well, we might have that discussion another time. We're going to move on though, because we have a guest in a studio. I am delighted to say that Gráinne O'Neill is standing across from me, and we're going to be talking tennis with Gráinne, because you used to play, and now you are the women in tennis lead with Tennis Ireland, and we're going to go through the US Open, the status of women's tennis in Ireland. Lots more in a little while, but you just happened to be here on the day that twice Grand Slam champion Simona Halep was banned from until 2026 for 2 separate anti-doping rule violations. This is something that's been brewing for a while. She had failed. She'd seems to be quite adamant that she is not guilty, but she has been banned now for up until 2026. Were you aware of this, and what do you know about it, Gráinne?
Hi, first off, thanks so much for having me. We're
no worries.
Delighted to be here.
And we're hitting you with an anti-doping story. We're so sound like that.
Straight into it. No, I think I actually was just looking at her social medias to see if she would release any statement, and she, about an hour ago, released quite a lengthy statement. Again, she denies the decision. She says she intends to appeal it. She's been very outspoken with all of this, so I suppose this is a breaking story in the fact that the ban has been placed, so it's all relatively new, but it'll be interesting to see what way it progresses in terms of her appealing the decision and whether anything will come of it. But it's just, I suppose, yeah, it's just really sad to see. And I think in any scenario like that, you kind of have to go with the anti-doping authority and what they decide. Mm-hmm. And that's the decision they've made.
The tribunal did accept that Simona Halep's case for taking a supplement which was contaminated could well have happened, but the concentration of the Roxadustat found in a positive sample, the amount was too big. But there was also questions over her athlete biological passport, and I just have found the last line very interesting, where the APBB charge was upheld as three independent experts were unanimous that likely doping was the explanation for the irregularities in Halep's profile. It was likely. That's enough to do it in tennis. I thought that was a big stance to take.
Yeah, I can't say I have a massive amount of experience in the area of anti-doping. It's all new to me as well, but
we did just land this on you because it's just
we've been very unfair. Yeah,
we are being unfair. You didn't get a chance to do anything.
We needed a tennis voice and you were here.
That's it. Well, I think even for herself, like, her background is in tennis. Like, she played junior tennis. She went straight into pros. She's obviously risen to the top of the game. If it is a case, she's been tested numerous times.
Yeah. This isn't, and she said that in her statement that she's been tested hundreds of times. She's never failed a test. She's adamant that this is an incorrect finding, and she plans to fight it till... well, as long as you can possibly find it, fight it. And it's quite interesting to see her be so outspoken about the fact that she's saying that she didn't do this, that she's not guilty of this charge.
And I think an interesting point is a lot of the coaches that have previously coached her have been outspoken in terms of their support. So you do have to look at that in terms of the background staff, what they're saying and everything else. But it's a breaking story. We just have to see what way it develops now.
So she's 31, and this question you will be able to answer. If she's 31 and she's banned until 2026, from a tennis playing perspective, is this the end of her?
Well, based off Novak Djokovic, it certainly isn't. It definitely isn't. I'd like to say it's not. Look, with anything, I think the last few years have shown that there is a lot of comeback queens in terms of Caroline Wozniacki coming back, having played. Serena's been outspoken in terms of coming back after having her child. Same with Naomi Osaka. So I definitely wouldn't rule her out, but it definitely puts a dampener on her tennis career to date, and it just remains to be seen if people will continue to support her after the ban or not.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll see how. The good news is, Gwen, you're in for the hour, so we'll see what happens for the next while. And while you're here, we might be throwing some more stuff at you. We're going to leave that for now. We will be chatting tennis in a little while again, but now we're going to turn our attention to football. I'm delighted to say that journalist from The Independent, Miguel Delaney, joins us now. Miguel, how are you?
Not too bad, thanks. Not too bad.
Thanks so much for joining us. You have been writing about the situation with Stephen Kenny and who could potentially succeed him. And the information that you seem to have anyway, Miguel, is that the Football Association are going to resist any attempt from Ireland to appoint England under 21 manager Lee Carsley if Stephen Kenny is sacked. Now, he's still in the job, obviously, but we're speculating to our heart's content about what's going to happen over the next few weeks and months. Even if the FA resist, can Lee Carsley make his own decision here?
Oh yeah, of course. And ultimately, I think, given also how much the FA value him, that they would be willing to maintain a good relationship. I mean, I know there's been obviously a lot of reporting in Ireland, but they being based in London, and actually my primary job now be covering England and the FA here. I suppose I've got it from that perspective. But the way they see it, and it's well known now. At some point, they expect. An approach. It might initially be informal, and it feels unfortunate to be talking about Stephen Kenny in this way, but the reality of the job. But the FA would expect an approach at some point, and if it gets to that, they would at least, I think, explain to Lee Carsley that there is potential for him to eventually be promoted to the senior job. I mean, this is a growing trend now in international football that actually both Stephen Kenny and Gareth Southgate are examples of. That it's now a different sort of job to the club game. And while the expectation would usually be that a federation as huge as England would go for a big name from the club game, they would at least think more now about potentially promoting someone. But I suppose if it gets to that, from Carsley's perspective, it's maybe a big risk to take, especially, I mean, Southgate, he decided after the 2022 World Cup that he was going to stay on another campaign. That could happen again. And he's been presented with a job that we know he would be interested in, which the Irish, I say presented, I mean, there's still a few variables to come here, but I think just the way everything is pointing, the feeling is that Kenny will get to the end of this campaign, then there'll be some sort of approach for Carsley. And the FA will resist that. But I suppose then if that happens, it comes down to how much Lee Carsley wants it.
It's interesting, just the whole Lee Carsley situation. We know that he has had the success with the England team, and that fantastic final against Spain at the Euros was absolutely brilliant. They do have unbelievable players, though, I must say. Stephen Kelly said last night that if you were to put the 11 on paper, like, there's a lot of comparisons to be made with the Ireland senior team and who's got the better starting 11. But just in terms of his managerial experience, how much does he have, and how different would it be to have to step up to an Ireland senior job, Miguel?
Well, I mean, I think as a few people have quipped today, a manager whose main experience or main suitability for the role is an under 21 job without too much experience at the top club level. Well, that sounds familiar. that's why there is a risk. But I think it just points to, I suppose, the situation the FAI are in, and why I suppose the list of potential names after that is relatively thin. Kenny's wage, I think it's believed to be around 300,000 a year. I mean, that could be competitive. And just from speaking to people in football, more so on the English side, who would say, I mean, if you had a quite a sophisticated recruitment team who are willing to think outside the box or take maybe different risks, you could come up with some interesting names at that sort of wage and this sort of job, but especially with the attractiveness of players like Evan Ferguson and Ogbeni. But I mean, maybe this points maybe where the FAI now, where obviously it's going through a state of transition, they don't necessarily have that sort of recruitment team. And that usually leads you into situations where you go for figures who either have a connection to the team or there's a cultural proximity in terms of football, and which means Lee Carsley is left as the best option, essentially an up-and-coming, a promising up-and-coming manager, quite well-respected, with an Irish connection as a previous international. After that, I mean, one of the names, but this is, I mean, I think... At this point, Carsley is so far the top option, should Kenny go, that anyone else is way behind. But like some of the names, one of the names I have had said to me is Kieran McKenna at Ipswich Town. But even that actually could be more difficult to do than Carsley, because Ipswich Town are currently, they're putting in huge investments trying to get back to the Premier League.
Miguel, Martin O'Neill was also out in the press and intimated that the soccer journalists haven't been as hard on Stephen Kenny as they were on him. He's intimated that it was the soccer journalists who got Stephen Kenny his job, and now they're all still standing behind him. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a fairly narrow and personalised interpretation from O'Neill. I think he had his difficulties I caught some of the O'Neill era when I worked for the Irish press. It was in better times when he qualified for Euro 2016. He wasn't happy with some of the criticism. He speaks about the Irish press keeping Kenny in the job now. Well, the big debate at the moment in the Irish press is that, I mean, and the widespread feeling is that Kenny should go. I think it's more, I mean, they were in two completely different contexts. Really, what O'Neill was in charge of was pretty much the last days of, I would actually say, a 30 to 40 year Jack Charlton era. That was, I mean, the generation he had taken through to Euro 2016. I think overall O'Neill's period was successful, but that was kind of the end of that generation of players, that kind of Italian 90 generation, or at least players who, I mean, more so that had been influenced by Italian 90. That had been their formation. What Kenny has overseen is really almost a completely different era, as we try and do something different, as we attempt to overhaul our coaching infrastructure. And all of this, of course, through huge ructions in the FAI, where obviously there's been financial issues that's affected coaching as well. And so it's just a completely different context of job. And hence, Kenny was maybe given more. But when some of that comes down to the type of managers they are, where O'Neill was always, I mean, O'Neill made it about purely about results, because he himself is a short-term results manager. I mean, I don't mean that it prohibits the O'Neill doing well in the long term, but he does view it in terms of their next game in that way. Whereas Kenny, it's been about a project, and it was a step back in that sense. So it's just I can see it maybe from the perspective that O'Neill is looking at it, but I think it's a narrow interpretation.
What about Rafa Benitez, Miguel?
And so, I mean, that was a name I mentioned today in my report. I mean, it's one of those. It's basically, I think. I have to be careful what I say here in terms of who can speak. me, but one of those where certain involved figures are trying to put his name in the hat. He did recently take a job with Celta Vigo. But just from that perspective, given what the FAI are trying to do, and I mean, for all the kind of debate about Stephen Kenny, and what he represents is what they persist to, which is a more progressive style of football, changing approach, bringing young players through. So I'd be surprised if they went for a kind of that sort of pragmatic type of manager that Rafa Benitez represents. But I suppose he is one of the kind of the bigger names that they could feasibly get. But then given what Benitez might demand, I think we probably can't hit his wages.
It does feel like it keeps coming back to Carsley, and he was actually on Game On back in July after they won those Euros. He was speaking to Damien O'Mara. Let's hear what he had to say.
You'll be aware, no doubt, that your name is one that's linked with the Irish job. Now, I'm very conscious that we have a manager, we have an inherently decent man in the job. There's no vacancy at the minute, but you know, you're aware of that, no doubt. Is that something that might even be on your radar as something you'd like to have on your CV at some point in the future?
Yeah, to be honest, it's not something that I've thought about. To be honest, I think like you've just said there, Stephen Kenny's in the job. He's doing a good job. Under tough circumstances as well. You know, thinking of the pool of players that from my generation that he had to pick from compared to now, there's definitely a transition that's going on. So I'm definitely concentrating on what I'm doing now, and like I said, not looking too far ahead. Mm.
So Miguel, does he want it?
I think from everything I'm hearing, he would be very intrigued by it.
Okay.
But not to the point that I think that he would like push completely out of his job right now, because I think the FA would at least try and offer him a vision for a future there as well.
A pretty great answer, wasn't it?
He said all the right things at the right time.
Absolute perfection.
He's good in the media as well.
He's made for the job, I'd say, listening to him.
Miguel, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. We will be keeping an eye on what you've been writing, because you do seem to have your finger on the pulse, a few connections there. And looking forward to seeing what the next while brings us here. Thanks, Miguel. Talk to you soon.
Yes, thank you. Bye.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us. We will be returning to Gráinne to talk tennis after that. A little bit overexcited there and hit the button too early, Ruby.
Don't worry, Marie.
These things happen. I'm excited to talk tennis. Gráinne O'Neill is still with us. So, Gráinne, you are the women in tennis, lead with Tennis Ireland, but you've had a bit of a tennis career as well. And we will talk about the US Open in just a minute, but I do want to have a chat with you about the journey that you went on as well, because it's quite fascinating to go over to Ireland to play tennis in Ohio State, to give it a shot. It must have been really difficult. And I think particularly for tennis players, because it feels like there's a lot playing at a high level. How difficult is it to be a tennis player, to try and make it as a tennis player, Gráinne?
Yeah, there's absolutely no denying it's difficult. Like the sport itself is individual, so it's very much like a self-motivated sport. It's what you put in is the results that you'll get out. But for me, going to the States was a no-brainer, because it was an opportunity for more competition, still getting my degree. So it was kind of like hand in hand. It was just an amazing experience in terms of the amount of facilities, the support. I went from obviously playing myself individually to jumping on a team with 8 girls of similar standard, with coaches, physio, all the support I could have had. So it was great for me in terms of developing as a tennis player. And one thing definitely is just learning to win ugly, because just so many matches you play in your time over there in the 4 years. So you just kind of learn how to win.
Grind it out,
exactly, yeah.
You went there after winning the under-18s national championship, which was back in 2010. You obviously got a scholarship away you went. Yeah. Were your dreams, though, to be Coco Gauff, Serena Williams? Was that your aspiration?
I'd love to say, yeah, obviously it was. I think it was a natural progression for me, having kind of got the national championship in Ireland, kind of say, look, I want to expand, but also still want to get a degree to give me options, obviously, outside of tennis. I did have aspirations. I think once you do go to the States and kind of getting that showcase of all the competition there, it did kind of make me realise that, look, it's going to take a lot to go onto the pro circuit after. And I think those 4 years definitely made me appreciate tennis and definitely the competitive side of it. But I kind of felt that was probably my limit with my tennis career. That's not to say I don't still play.
Yeah.
I'll probably continue playing well into my 80s, 90s, hopefully. But that was probably, I kind of realised in the States, just the level of competition and the standard.
Is that because of their athletic ability, their genetics, or is it because we don't have the structures and we didn't have the pathways and what you needed to equip you as a child to put in the hours that you needed to propel you to the level that they were at? Or is it just pure, they're better at it?
Well, I think for me anyway, from my own personal experience, going to the States gave me the opportunity to have all the resources. Mm-hmm. So it was all the resources on my doorstep, getting my degree. So it kind of went hand in hand. I think in order for you to do it yourself, you have to have a lot of support. And like Coco winning the US Open, she has a massive team around her. And she has a lot of people kind of allowing her to succeed. So for me, look, I felt like there was opportunity if I wanted to go pro, but a lot of it would have had been on myself and finding the funding and going about it myself. It's a really lonely sport. Everyone who goes onto the pro circuit will say that. If you don't have a team around you, it's really, really lonely. But obviously you, as an athlete, you're going for those, the highest of the highs, but there's obviously the lowest of lows as well. It goes hand in hand with the sport.
Do you feel when you turned up as an 18-year-old in Ohio, you were on a level playing field with the athletes your age, or were they ahead of you?
I'll tell you, I stepped onto a court and it was humid and the sun was beating down and I said, I'm not used to this. No, I think you adapt. Look, for me, it was great that they were all similar standard, and they kind of pushed me on as a player as well. And just to have a team around you, like I came from having had kind of organising my own hits and going out to tournaments. And obviously I got a lot of support from my parents and my family, but a lot of it is on yourself to kind of organise everything. Whereas when you land in the States, for me anyway, it was a team behind you and a team to make you a better player, but ultimately to make you a better person and to improve as a person as a whole rather than the athlete. Yeah, no, it was definitely an eye-opening experience when I went over there. I realised how many times I said grand and crack didn't really translate over there. So there was a few testy moments, but no, it was a brilliant experience for me.
You work for Tennis Ireland now, so you obviously see everybody that's coming up through the ranks, and you're well aware of what they have in the USA and what we have here. Do we have enough in place? Is there enough support? Is there enough resources to maybe someday make the next Coco Gauff, to develop the next Coco Gauff?
Absolutely. Look, that's what we hope. Certainly, we're kind of in the process of designing our new five-year strategy for Tennis Ireland. And one thing we're focusing in on is changing from high performance to performance development, because we kind of see it as building blocks. So you have to develop as a player in order to get to the high performance stage. So I think there's a huge amount of juniors who are in line of maybe making it through to junior Grand Slams. And for me, that's a building block then to getting into the pro tennis circuit, and then hopefully for making qualies or getting into main draws or Grand Slams. But it's building blocks. I'd love to see an Irish kid kind of do something similar to Coco Gauff.
Tearing it up. Yeah, but look at McIlroy in the golf, and you know, the way we were able to produce so many top level golfers.
Absolutely.
Can be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But does that go hand in hand with how many golf clubs we have compared to tennis clubs?
Yeah, I suppose there's an element of that. I think we definitely have we have 183 affiliated clubs at the minute, and we have a lot of public courts. So I don't necessarily think it's the facility. It probably is just similar to golf, having those inspiring role models that you can look up to and say, you know, Rory's done it, so can I. So there is an element of that. But look, you have to be hopeful. I'm absolutely hopeful that we will get there at some stage.
You do sound it anyway, so that's good. And what about your role? So we are seeing quite a lot of these women in Name the Sport lead. So it's great to see that there is a focus on developing female athletes and giving them the opportunities and support. So what does your role entail?
So like that, women in tennis lead, there's a lot of women in sport leads. So my role, the main aim is just to improve the overall landscape for women and girls in Irish tennis. So there's a couple of different areas I focus in on. The first being getting more women actively participating within clubs. The second being getting more female coaches and officials involved in our sport, and then obviously rising to the highest levels. The third is around leadership and governance. So more women on club committees, provincial branches or national board. And then finally, just generating more increased visibility. We're quite a good sport in terms of equal equal participation and kind of equal access to changing rooms, competitions. It's always men and women. We're quite equal in that regard, but there's definitely areas we can improve on with coaching, with officiating, with leadership. So that's kind of what I've been focusing on for the last 3 years.
And what about the perception of tennis? So like there is a tennis club where I live, but I would never think of going because I wouldn't even know what to do. Like,
you're too busy to go, Marie, between GAA, hurling, camogie, soccer. I mean, you're poor lads, like, there's not enough day in the weeks for them.
I have a few hours during the day. There is a tennis club up the road, but it's like, even I wouldn't think to go and knock on the door and say, can I join, or, you know, how do I start and things like that. It's, it feels like maybe the visibility that you mentioned, or the because I know in golf now they have programs for trying to get women involved in golf. Is there similar for women with tennis?
Yeah, absolutely. So
there we go.
We've
I reckon I beat Ruby in tennis as well.
We'll have to see that. We'll have to get that organized. So we'd have a women's try tennis program. So it's exactly like
the
golf.
Same. Yeah.
And the whole idea is to kind of incentivize women that once you've completed the 6-week program, you've an overview of the shots, you can have a knock around and play a match, and then ideally you're getting straight into a club and you're fitting in straight away in internal competition. So we have that structure in place. We've a good few locations now that we've done across the 3 years. And definitely, like, through our website, we're always promoting and social media, like, any of the new locations. I have to say the take up is always brilliant. It's more so getting the organisation of getting the programme started, and the women always follow. So I think the really important thing for me that I've seen, that I've found great, is that I think it's 49 or 48, it's close to 50% of those women who've gone through the programme have then gone on to join their local clubs. So that's kind of the aim with the programme, and hopefully we'll keep expanding.
This isn't exactly your department now, Grainne, but what about kids in schools?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we have a schools tennis programme in place, and that's been ongoing for the last number of years. Definitely, I'd say schools has been great in terms of giving them an introduction to the sport, and then whether they actually take it up in a club environment or just even publicly. Like, we have a programme called Parks Tennis as well, which provides access to tennis in more of an introductory manner. It's usually done in the summertime, so we definitely have those pathways in place. It's just it's seeing if your school has that in place, and obviously we're on hand as well if there is any schools who are interested. That we'd love to have them involved in a school's tennis program.
We mentioned Coco Gauff and just how unbelievable she is, and the team that she has and the support around her. And she's obviously so young, a teenager. And then at the opposite end, you have Novak Djokovic. There's actually a video gone viral of him. I don't know if you saw it today, but on social media, his very first tennis lesson, and he's only 4. It's amazing just watching him. It's worth checking out. But to see him do what he's doing at 36 and to be seem to doing it at absolute ease from someone who's obviously so involved in tennis, it must be mind-blowing.
It's absolutely incredible. Djokovic is kind of one of those, you either love him or you hate him. He's a bit of a Marmite figurehead in sport. I'd have to say, I don't love him. But no, there's no denying the impact he's had on tennis. And I think it's just so impressive that he's been so successful at the highest, where there's just such a finite margin between winning and losing. And I think what's really interesting, he's been so successful, and he's now tied with Margaret Court in the all-time Grand Slam record. But he's done that at a time when there was two other sporting legends in Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. So I think that just makes it even more mind-blowing what he's achieved. Absolutely, it's incredible. And I think, look, everyone's always kind of saying, is there no talent coming through to beat him? There is. They're just still not good enough, or they're just on the cusp. So who knows how many more Grand Slams he'll win.
Ruby, when you're competing at that level like Djokovic is, and like you've obviously been there in your own sport, is it better to have people pushing you around you, or like if you're on your own, the clear leader, and you know it comes easy, which situation would you prefer to be in?
Well, I was of a generation of brilliant jockeys as well, like between Tony McCoy, Barry Geraghty, Paul Carberry. I was of that generation like that, so I would have to say that I would hope that we all made each other better. I firmly believe we did because of the standard that was there. So I would say, obviously Andy Murray, Nadal, Federer, they pushed Djokovic. The bar was very high, so I would think that's a good thing. And obviously Djokovic's longevity is incredible at 36. And even some of the tennis books are some of the best books
Yeah.
Autobiographies I read. Agassiz is an incredible book. So is Jimmy Connors. They're brilliant books. And even for kids to watch King Richard, it's a brilliant movie. There is some great storylines in tennis that can catch your imagination. To read Agassiz's book is incredible. Yeah. To watch the determination to understand what a player is going through in the fourth, fifth set. Like, even their vision when they're so tired. I just found that incredible, Grainne.
Yeah, that's actually, I agree, Ruby, that's one of my favourite books, autobiography or not. It's just, what I found really fascinating was how much he hated the sport, but how successful he was and what the mindset was, like you said, in those tough moments. Tennis, it really gives some amazing storylines and fairy tale runs and dramatic matches, and it has it all. Agassiz is definitely one of my
It's relentless books. Though, isn't it? It feels like a game that is absolutely relentless, and when you're trying to make it and trying to succeed and forge your career or whatever it is, when at your college, it just must be all consuming and non-stop.
Yeah, I always say to everyone as well, I always remember my losses way more than my wins. Like, still to me, I can still remember a match where I had match points and I know exactly what shot I missed in order to lose that match. So it is kind of one of those sports, the highs are so high, but the lows are awful.
When you looked in at someone, so successful as Coco Gauff winning a US Open at 19, and you go back to Raducanu winning it, she hasn't had an easy ride since then. How does Coco Gauff, with her team, look for a different passage to next year?
Yeah, I think it's even just being healthy as an athlete. Raducanu, unfortunately, has come up with a few niggling injuries that have just kept her off the court. And I think for Coco, you have to look at her impressive run up to the US Open. Like, she had a WTA 500. She won a WTA 500 title along with a WTA 1000. She had made the final of the French Open last year. She lost to the former world number one Swiatek at that stage. So for me, I kind of see it as her progression as a player. Like, she burst onto the scene at 15 years of age, which, first off, 15 is incredible to come onto a professional circuit and do as well as she did. She beat her idol in the first round of Wimbledon, got to the fourth round. So I kind of see her career. She's now currently the new world number three. She went from four to three. So for her, it's really been a building block to get to where she has. And I suppose I see it as a testament to the team around her. She's developed a really close-knit team that have kind of progressed her game from more of a defensive style to an all-round player and a threat. And I think her win and her first Grand Slam is testament to that.
There's a really interesting article in The Guardian today, and it goes through the changes that she made and bringing in the new coaches. And there was a really good line in it that the author wrote, that instead of transforming her game, she learned that her existing strengths were sufficient. And that's pretty amazing for a 19-year-old.
Yes. Because everyone kind of forgets as well, when you're a tennis player, it's only you on the court. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to figure it out for yourself and not afraid to switch things up, or not afraid to believe in the shots that you have, and not focus so much on, I hope they don't hit to my forehand, I hope they don't hit to my backhand. And I think for Coco, she's really developed that. And I mean, everyone also forgets she's currently the world number one in doubles. So she really is a dual threat when it comes to singles and doubles.
You say it's an individual sport, but when we're watching Wimbledon, the highlight of our tennis year, and you watch the player, and male or female, stares into the coach's box and the coach is staring back, is there an invisible sign language going on there, that they're kind of having some sort of a conversation, that they have hand signals of what's going on? Because they do spend a lot of time looking at each other.
Yeah, some of them just straight up talk to each other. So, there definitely is. Look, they've spent their whole lives together, so they probably know each other, that coach to player relationship. They know each other through and through. I'd like to believe there's, you know, the widening of the eyes is kind of saying one thing and the narrowing of the eyes says another. But yeah, no, it's, I just think Coco is such an amazing role model for women's tennis, for just women in sport in general. Like, for her to be 16 or 19, like, she's mature beyond her years.
Yes, she is.
She kind of showcases that through any of the media coverage she's had and her conferences as well, her post-match conferences. Like, she really has shown so much maturity throughout the US Open and her whole career today.
And she's only getting started as well, so we'll have lots of years of Coco Gauff. Grainne, thank you so much for coming in. It was really nice to chat about tennis in Ireland as well, because we do get get so focused on the international stage and we forget that there's a whole lot of tennis here as well, and lots of opportunities for people that want to get involved. So we really appreciate you coming in and taking the time. We're going to take a break, but do stay with us. We have William Creighton coming up. We also have to chat soccer with Mark Langdon, and we'll be going to Turner's Cross ahead of Ireland's under 21 game against San Marino.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are going to switch lanes, literally switch lanes anyway, and we are going to turn our attention to motor racing. And I'm delighted to say that William Creighton joins us now on the line. And William has become the first Irish driver since the late Craig Breen to be crowned the FIA Junior WRC champion. Congratulations, first and foremost, and you're very welcome, William. How are you?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm good. The last few days have been tough and quite crazy to finish the rally in Greece. But since we finished, we've had so many messages of support and congratulations. So it's been a really nice few days.
And you're entitled to each and every one of them, William. But you headed into Greece with a 20.9-point lead in the JWRC Championship. But not everything went to plan in Greece. And I think Friday was a pretty tricky day.
Yeah, it didn't go quite to plan. We started the rally and we had some issues with the engine. So the way the rules work, basically we had to retire to save the car so that we could fix what was wrong and then restart the event on Saturday. So it wasn't looking so good at that point for the overall championship. And I wouldn't say we definitely didn't give up, but we knew that it was quite unlikely that we'd be able to win. And when we restarted on Saturday, some things fell our way with other guys running into problems, and we set some really good stage times, and we just started to build our way back up. And we put ourselves then in position on Saturday afternoon that we could fight for the championship. And then it just meant on Sunday that we really had to get to the car to the finish line, and the championship would have been ours. So it was quite a crazy turn of events after what happened on Friday.
For those of us that are not experts in rally championships, when you say you had to retire on Friday, does that mean everyone else keeps racing on and acquiring points and you have to go back to the garage and you just don't play that day?
Exactly, yeah. We have to travel back to the pits and let the guys work in the car in service, and they basically had to take the engine out and fit a lot of parts to it, and we take quite big penalties for that. So when we restarted on Saturday, we were a long way back, and as I say, it was just some things fell our way with other competitors having problems. And then because we won a couple of the stages, you get a point for each stage that you win. That also helped put us back in the position to fight for the championship.
So what does this mean for your career now to have such a significant win?
It's massive. There's quite a big prize on offer that allows me to compete in the World Rally Championship in the next category up next year. So it's huge in terms of the boost it gives that I can jump to the next level of the sport, but also, you know, being recognised and being put on alongside some of the names like Craig that you mentioned, it's a real honour.
Yeah, it must be. And look, everybody knows who Craig was, and we've had him on this programme quite a number of times, and he died tragically following that crash in Croatia back in April. For you to emulate him, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, it was quite emotional. I mean, Craig epitomised Irish rallying, that, you know, we all go to have fun, and that's why it makes it so sad what happened to him. But, you know, any opportunity that Craig got to drive a rally car, he loved it, and he was so passionate about it, and that's what made him so unique. So, you know, he'll never be replaced, and his personality was, you know, so unique for the World Championship. And just to be mentioned alongside him and win the same championship that he did back in 2011, it's an honour for me.
Yeah, amazing. And he really put kept the sport in people's minds all the time when he was doing so well. It's always really interesting, and we had Grania on there speaking about tennis, how people get into the different sports that they end up getting into. For you, how did you get into it, William?
I think I grew up on a farm, and there was always either some form of machinery to drive or an old car about the yard. So I guess I was always into driving, and my dad did a bit of rallying for a bit of fun, and I started go-kart racing. And I mean, it was never the plan to try and become a junior world rally champion, and just one thing led to another, and we were able to put ourselves in this position. And there's so many people to thank, and you know, Motorsport Ireland have been working in collaboration to create a Motorsport Ireland Rally Academy with John Coyne, the founder, and it's only been running now a couple of years, and to already produce, you know, our world champion is a credit to those guys and the support that they give me and my co-driver Liam Regan. So there's so many people behind the scenes and that allow us to be able to compete at this level.
Your success is obviously a huge boost to Motorsport Rally Ireland Academy, but you'd no aspirations maybe to follow your mum and go eventing or show jumping, no?
I told my mum that I was coming on the show and that it would be hosted by you, Ruby, and I said that maybe you'll know her, but her response was that I think she's a little bit older than you, and that maybe before your time.
A fraction, William. But anyway, we won't go down that road. We won't
she'll
mother's age on air. She'll not talk, you might be a world champion, but she won't talk to you for that one. But what does this mean for the Rally Academy of Ireland? I know your success is a boost for it, but where do you go from junior? How do you get to senior? Where does that funding come from? Where is the next step? Where is the next step for you?
The next step is up a category in the World Championship, and it's called WRC2. So this year was WRC3. So yeah, it's one step closer to, I mean, the next step after WRC2 is into the manufacturers in the full WRC car. So it puts you one step closer to that, and it also, you know, it makes you aware to a lot of the manufacturers who are competing in the sport. So for my own career, it's a massive jump, but also, you know, like I said, the Motorsport Ireland Rally Academy, who have been supporting me, it's a reward for all the effort that, you know, the guys are putting in there. And, you know, I'm not the only driver or co-driver in that academy, so it's a boost for all the other guys as well. And I think whenever you get a big result like that, it motivates everyone that extra bit, and you know, hopefully it can be continued with more success.
Well, you most certainly have given you a shop window that you put yourself in. I hope someone was looking. William, thanks a million for taking our call. I wish you all the success in the future. We have a quick break to take. We'll be back with Mark Langdon and some soccer news.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. The Republic of Ireland under-21s are hoping to make it 2 wins from 2 in their Euro 2025 qualifier when they take on San Marino in Turner's Cross this evening. Darren Frell is there for us. Darren, I'd say there's a lot of interest in this exciting young team down in Cork.
Absolutely, Marie, and I think we need some good news as well. It's been a difficult week or so, hasn't it, with the senior team not doing so well. I was here last Friday night, Marie. They played Turkey, and I'm not going to lie to you, I was absolutely buzzing on the drive home after it, because just the nature of it, you know, they went down twice, came from behind twice to win it close to the end. And it wasn't just the dramatic comeback, it was, you know, the ability we saw on display, the teamwork, and obviously the character. But I think most of all, Marie, what I saw was, you know, a really top manager making the changes when things weren't going their way, went to his bench, and all those changes played their part in that comeback, which is, you know, really promising, both on and off the field.
Yeah, it's a really exciting team, and as you said, Jim Crawford there is getting the job done, and he even said before this one, okay, it is San Marino, but he's not taking anything for granted, because Ireland teams have known in the past there is no really easy games anymore in international football, but tonight should be straightforward, you'd imagine, Darren.
You think so? Like they've played two games already, so this is our second game, but they've played two already. So they lost 2-0 to Latvia and then 7-0 to Norway. So they've conceded 9 goals, okay? And I'm a small bit wary of that result. We lost out on the last Europeans to Israel. It went to a penalty shootout. Israel went on then to contest the semi-finals of the European Championships. So this San Marino team caused that Israel team some problems not so long ago. So I'm a small bit wary. Look, maybe it's in the Irish DNA as well. We struggle to win these games. I don't expect them to struggle today. I think San Marino will be really deep, really compact. But I think if we can make a good start, and I love the look of this team as well tonight, Marie. Like, he's kind of going with the more standard 4-4-2. I think they're going to go right at these. And there's lots of muscle as well. Great to see you know, Sinclair Armstrong, who made his international debut the other night. This guy is a handful, and yeah, I think he could be a handful for San Marino tonight.
Absolutely, and he's great fun as well. Anyone who follows him on social media, he's a brilliant personality, which is exactly what you want as well. Darren Farrell, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. That game is on RTE2 television this evening, and it is coverage is getting underway at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much for that, Darren. We are going to stay with football, though. Mark Langdon of the Racing Post joins us now, and we are going to return to a topic of conversation that we had at the very top of the show, and that was anti-doping. Mark, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, thanks, Marie. Yeah, happy to, always happy to talk anti-doping.
Oh, well, I'm glad. I'm glad you're here then, because we have a big one. It's a big story. Paul Pogba has failed an anti-doping test, and if it goes the way as many of them do, he won't be playing football for quite a while. Can you give us a little bit about the background in this story?
Yeah, so first of all, Pogba is yet to sort of, the B sample will be the key one, mm-hmm. but we should know the result of that pretty soon. And then, you know, a decision will be made. Obviously, if that was found to be positive, then, you know, it will be up to the authorities to decide what the length of ban would be. So, I mean, the Italian newspapers are reporting that this has come about from maybe a food supplement within the US, and the key thing here really is that Paul Pogba, according to the Italian newspapers today, has said Juventus are claiming, and or it's been reported that Pogba did not sort of run this past the, you know, Juventus doctors, and there are different laws in terms of the US in terms of, you know, what might be considered sort of banned substances compared to, you know, what happens in football, and what, you know, the Juventus doctors would have known straight away. Yes, you can do. Yes, you can take that. No, you cannot take that. So it would, in theory, I mean, if I sort of fast forward to it, if he were to be found, you know, sort of guilty, and that the B sample also comes back as positive, it would enable Juventus, probably within their rights, to release Pogba from his contract, because he hasn't sort of asked them whether he should have taken it. And I think there are some people in Italy that think that would be a very convenient thing for Juve to do, because Pogba has been awful on his return. You know, he's barely been fit. And so maybe awful is the wrong word, but certainly in terms of value for money, they've had absolutely nothing from him on the pitch. He's on huge wages. He's always sort of been injured really for them. So yeah, it's since he won the World Cup, really, it's been sort of downward spiral for Paul Pogba. And you know, we await the B sample results, but not been a very good week, not been a very good year, probably not been a very good sort of 4 or 5 years for him, if we're being honest.
No, it hasn't, but it's provisionally suspended for elevated levels of testosterone. What exactly was he eating?
that's a good question. So all we know is it was food supplement. So you know, I wouldn't know beyond that.
There have been sports people in the past who I won't name who have eaten wild boar and blamed that, but I don't think it was wild boar though.
No, and I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, people be again, not talk about this case, but we've seen Andre Onana, you know, for instance, sort of, you know, he was banned for a long time, the Manchester United goalkeeper, for what is, you know, widely believed to have just been a simple mistake. It was sort of late at night, and he took you know, his partner's tablets rather than his own, and you know, I don't think there was anybody that kind of was accusing him of trying to cheat or anything like that.
Yeah, but Ruby's not buying any of this.
Hang on, right? You're a sports person, right? So yes, you're going to be drug tested all the time. So you take your wife's or your partner's tablets instead of your own. Is the first thing you not do not go to the doctor and say, your club, and say, by the way, I've taken these. You get tested, you declare them on the sheet, I have taken this by accident. I can't hack this. Oh, afterwards. Yeah, do you know what? I might have done that.
I've been sleepwalking.
Yeah, I know. I agree that, you know, I think that, you know, it is up to the athlete to take more responsibility and to, you know, alert their club. And, you know, Juventus have got you know, very strict protocols on what you're supposed to do at all times. You know, it's not ambiguous. There is a you know, a clear kind of path for that Pogba or any player there has to take, and that's not been followed. So, you know, I think Juventus are very upset with Paul Pogba at this stage. I mean, we await the B sample, and you know, hopefully, I mean, for Pogba's sake, it comes back clear, and you know, he can maybe try to get his football career back on track. But you know, I think at this moment in time, Juventus are. Are clearly not happy with Pogba for not declaring what he'd been eating.
Over the last few hours, I've been reading a lot on him because of this story. And you know, over the years, you hear the different things that have happened, and you know, in isolation, they're shocking, but when they're all together, they're all really bad. Why do you think everything has unravelled for him?
That's a hard question. I mean, I think. He's had a lot of issues off the pitch. You know, he's been involved in a.
I think we might have lost Mark there. So
Pogba's been, accused his brother of blackmailing him, and you know, that has reached a critical point, really. Mm. So, I mean, I think he's had a lot going on off the pitch, as well as that, but he just can't stay fit. And you know, some people say that's down to the life that you lead as an athlete, and you should be fully focused on football. It's hard to say whether he does that. You know, he obviously has a lot of off-field activities, but I'm sure he doesn't want to be injured. But he's just not been fit for the last few years, and you know, that ultimately is where the problem lies. Because if he was fit and playing well, you know, I don't think Juventus would mind paying him the money that they are.
Well, it's almost 7 o'clock, so we don't have time to get into whether or not he did try to put a spell on Mbappe. We might come back to that another time. But that story is out there. Mark Langdon, thank you so much for joining us. We have time for this evening. I won't be back tomorrow, neither will Ruby, but Shane will be here.
I'm still laughing. I know had the potential to be a great footballer, but putting a spell on Mbappe. Oh, Marie, please.
Yeah, look it up. It's a good story. It is a
no,
good story.
No, I have more things to do with my life.
Betty De Silva's up next.